precarity comes in many forms. A lot of countries in the global south have high levels of informality where workers have no social security, and these workers are often beyond the purview of labor protections. In India, for example, 71% of regular wage workers don't have a written contract.
In this program, we hear from two leading global worker advocates about how shifting demographics and technology are upending labor markets, making jobs increasingly precarious, boosting inequality, and deepening economic insecurity.
So the pandemic is exacerbating all of these adverse trends, and I think it's cast a spotlight on just how vulnerable how many people really are.
And the big concern, obviously, of all this is that we undo a lot of the progress that has been made over the last 10, 15 years, and we are unlikely to go back to the situation after the pandemic has been resolved. I'm Eckhard Ernst. I'm the chief of the Macroeconomic Policies and Jobs Unit at the International Labour Organization, and I'm working there mostly on long-term labour economic and macro issues, recently looking into the effect of the pandemic and technological change.
I'm Sabina Dewan. I'm the president and executive director of the Just Jobs Network. I'm also a senior visiting fellow at the Center for Policy Research in India.
And I'm Bruce Edwards. Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. The pandemic has caused millions of people to lose their jobs, and with robots on the rise and expanding work-from-home options for white-collar workers, it seems COVID-19 has ushered in a new normal for the global workplace. But Sabina Dewan and Eckhard Ernst argue that this new normal isn't really new at all. Dewan and Eckhard co-authored an article titled Rethinking the World of Work, published in the December 2020 issue of Finance and Development magazine. So workers across the globe were adversely affected almost immediately following the outbreak. What does this pandemic tell us about the precariousness of today's labor force?
So just to paint a picture for our listeners, I wanted to give you a little taste of what happened in India as soon as the lockdown was instituted. So India, a country of 1.3 billion and a labor force that is 500 million strong, went into complete lockdown on the 25th of March with very little notice. And so millions of workers that rely on a daily wage, many of whom are migrant workers, often six or more crowded in an urban slum dwelling of 8 square feet or so. And such workers rely on their daily wages to buy food from street vendors. And so when the country went into lockdown, millions of people across the country were left with no job, no wages, and no food. And this is just one picture of precarity. And I think it's imperative that governments across the globe acknowledge that they have fallen short in making adequate investments in resilience through investments in social protection and human capital.
Yeah, I think from the point of view of advanced economies, what is really striking about the impact of this pandemic is how unequal the precariousness of the workforce is actually distributed. I mean, we saw right from the beginning that the impact was extremely unequally distributed, with most of the, let's say, higher educated and white-collar workers could basically move to home offices, continue as if nothing had happened, whereas most other people had either to go into furlough schemes or were being laid off or moved into inactivity altogether. You see also across generation, there's a huge inequality of the impact, especially young people, younger workers, but also young people are still in education are highly affected by this crisis, whereas more advanced people or older workers, if you want, have been much less affected. And then the third group, obviously, that comes with this move towards teleworking and home office, where that a lot of female workers are very heavily negatively impacted.
Yeah, so with companies struggling and so many people having been laid off, will the pandemic, do you think, push more people toward these low-paying jobs in pure desperation?
Absolutely. I think we now realize that millions of people across the globe are one health emergency away from falling back into poverty. Low-income countries lost 11% in working hours when compared to the fourth quarter of 2019, and low-middle-income countries lost 15.6%. This loss in working hours translates also into a loss of wages that really affects aggregate demand that then creates a vicious circle, leading to even more job losses, less working time, less disposable income, and straining fiscal budgets. So at the same time, we're also seeing several sectors in decline. So as hospitality, aviation, tourism all take a hit, small businesses that are failing, when the overall number of sectors and jobs goes down, particularly in light of a demographic bulge in the global south, which is, you know, they already have a large youth population and this population is growing. Taking all of these factors together, when there's less jobs in the economy and fewer sectors to support those jobs, what you see is a concentration of workers in fewer jobs and fewer sectors. And this oversupply of labor exerts downward pressure on wages and working conditions, which is highly problematic.
Yeah, Eckhart, Sabina just mentioned there that the demographics of this issue, how does it play in to the problem?
Well, I mean, in advanced economies, at least most of the immediate problems were solved through either furlough schemes or extension of unemployment benefits. So, I mean, preventing, let's say, an immediate rise in pressure on low-wage sectors or employment in low-wage sectors. And to a certain extent, if you want, the demographic change that we are seeing in advanced economies, the graying of the workforce certainly helps to ease off the pressure a bit from these sectors. The big concern is, and it's a similar concern to what Sabina just mentioned, is that how do you account for adjustment? Because there will be some adjustments. Certain sectors simply will not come back to the same extent as they have been before. And the question is what to do with all these people that are either unemployed or on furlough schemes. How do you bring them back into employment without necessarily putting further pressure on low-wage sectors? And I think that problem hasn't really been tackled properly yet.
And so, I mean, do you worry that rather than address the vulnerabilities of the workforce, that firms will just sort of concentrate on accelerating their automation programs? And how can governments and institutions like yours, the ILO and the Just Jobs Network, prevent that from happening?
I think even prior to the pandemic, we were seeing automation on the rise and technology on the rise. And there's no question that the pandemic is going to accelerate these trends. I think the pandemic has laid bare the vulnerabilities of a human workforce. And so firms are going to automate as the cost of technology decreases. And you know, skilling and reskilling workers also takes a lot of time and energy. And so when you can have technology actually be in some ways more productive, then we're definitely going to see that trend accelerate. But I think the important thing is, and this is why workers, governments, businesses need to work together, because ultimately businesses still need consumers. And so it is in their advantage to make sure that there is enough employment in the economy, because unless people are getting paid and unless people have wages, it's going to have an adverse impact. And here's where there's also a role for government to come in and regulate appropriately without stymieing innovation and advancement of technology, but making the necessary investments needed in human capital and in people and in social protection to ensure a more balanced outcome. Otherwise, we're just going to see technology exacerbate inequalities and lead to political and economic instability in the way that, to some extent, we are now seeing with globalization as well.
I mean, I think in addition to that, what is really problematic with automation is the fact that it's very firm specific. So you have certain firms, certain sectors that have been thriving with automating their processes, and especially in the digital economy, whereas many other firms and many other sectors have not been benefiting from these technological shifts. And we see that this crisis is exacerbating, as Sabine was saying, this, this shift, simply because some companies have been extremely successful in implementing new technologies. And you see that in a certain way also in how the stock market in some advanced economies have been just thriving and booming almost despite the fact that the overall economy has been depressed. And I think that one of the key questions here is really how to accompany these occupational transitions that are implied by this. There was always a bit of a naive belief that by just simply activating people who lost their jobs, they would automatically somehow miraculously find new opportunities somewhere else. And I think that with this now very specific technological change with very specific skill sets that is required in certain occupations, I think there needs to be indeed a closer collaboration between businesses, governments, and workers' organizations in order to make this transition possible. There, actually, interestingly enough, technology can help with that, but it requires much tighter collaboration between different institutions and organizations. And we at the ILO, at least, are trying to identify exactly what kind of mechanism could be put in place to make these occupation transitions proactive rather than passive.
And so we were obviously totally unprepared for this pandemic on many different levels. How do we better prepare for crises of this nature?
I think the important thing in preparing for a crisis of this nature is really ensuring that governments are investing in the resilience of their workforce. And this is something that Eckhart has written about and can also talk more about, but investments in resilience really come by ensuring that people have appropriate wages, appropriate social protection, social security, that they, you know, are competing in a society where they have an equality of opportunity as well as an opportunity for equality of outcome. And so, you know, investing in resilience, and governments need to do this by really making sure that we are doing the kinds of social sector spending that harnesses the productive potential of populations, and not thinking about efficiency and economic growth first and building resilience as a tier two priority. We need to flip that model around and think about how do we build societies that are equal, societies that are healthy, societies that are educated and skilled to compete in a 21st century workforce. How do we harness the productive potential of our people through good employment, what I like to call just jobs, so that we can then have better and stronger and more sustainable economic growth.
And I think just to expand on that point a bit, on the exclusive focus on efficiencies that we had in the past, I think it's really key to recognize how much pain this has created over the last 12 or 18 months in this crisis, simply that we have been looking so much into kind of making our healthcare system, for instance, more efficient, to kind of lower or decrease the number of beds in hospitals, to make doctors basically being more efficient in terms of carrying out their jobs. And at the end of the day, you realize that when it comes to such a strong, so hard hit crisis, we don't have enough resources that we can draw from in order to be able to respond to it quickly. We don't have enough intensive care units. We don't have enough nurses. We often don't have enough doctors either. And so if you look at just the European experience, those countries who actually were under pressure to shut down the economies were also those countries who didn't have enough resources to draw from. So there indeed needs to be more resilience. Resilience as a second leg, if you want, for our policymaking in order to be able to prepare for such large-scale crises, which are bound to happen again, whether it's a pandemic or financial crisis or climate crisis, etc. I think that there are many, many global crises that are likely to show their effects in the next decades. And we need to make sure to be prepared for that. And the only way is to leave, as they say, money on the table in order to be able to survive.
And speaking of resources, I mean, technology is a resource now that is so critical for so many people, rich and poor. Do you think that technology firms should be under greater scrutiny now? I mean, perhaps more regulated than they were before this pandemic?
There's no question that we are becoming increasingly reliant on technology. It's an integral part of our working lives, to our personal lives now. But we need to ensure that all companies, tech companies or not, are held to standards of fair competition.
Yeah, I would echo that definitely, that we need to kind of pull out again some of our old-fashioned competition policies and taxation policies that we have abandoned more or less over the last 20 years. I think that there is clearly a need for looking specifically on what this data economy, how this data economy is functioning, what kind of competition problems this data economy creates. But we need to also be more innovative in a sense. I mean, certain policies won't work for many reasons, for international competition reasons, etc. And I think that there are possibilities, including issues related to intellectual property rights, or, for instance, the possibility for governments to invest in some of these companies through sovereign data wealth funds and distribute some of the wealth that's generated by these companies to a larger population. So we need to be both bold in terms of applying our existing policies to restore a level playing field, but also be innovative in terms of finding new ways of sharing the gains that these companies definitely have created through the larger population.
And Bruce, if I could just add to what Eckhart just said, I think it's important for us to also think about new forms of governance, multilateral governance and regulation that's fit for a 21st century economy, where a lot of these companies, different kinds of gig work platforms, hire workers in one country but are registered in another. You know, they act as tech intermediaries without having employees per se. And so we really need to have a good long hard think on how do we actually govern these new emerging forms of work to ensure that there is fair competition and that we have a more balanced power distribution in addition to resources through policies like competition policy and taxation, as Eckhart mentioned.
Mm. So governments and international financial institutions are working hard to restart economic growth. But does strong economic growth mean more people in good paying jobs? Or is this pursuit of continuous economic growth misguided?
I think it's really important to acknowledge that economic growth is critical. But the composition of growth matters. The quality of the economic growth matters. What we want is labor-intensive growth. What we want is more of the benefits of growth to be reinvested in the kinds of policies that build worker resilience. So it's better health, it's better education, it's better skills training and apprenticeships. It is making sure that the workforce has the ability to transition to a very fast-moving 21st century economy and that has the resilience to be able to withstand the shocks that are likely to come our way, be it, as Eckhart said, be it a pandemic, be it shocks as a result of climate change, or, you know, other kinds of financial crises. So unless we're actually investing in people, and this is what investing in development means, we have to remember that growth is toward the end of development. And we can't have growth be an end to itself. So again, the composition and the quality of growth matters. And it's not just about redistribution. It's about thinking through what are the strategies for growth from the beginning, job-rich growth that actually build the resilience of people. And then you think about the redistribution. So we need to also reframe what we mean by economic growth and what we prioritize to achieve high levels of economic growth. It cannot come at the cost of people.
Yeah, and I would even be a bit more pessimistic, saying that we have seen in the past so many examples of especially developing countries where growth has been extremely strong, and nevertheless, the average person in that country hasn't really seen any of that improvement. I would say that, I mean, growth is only as good as it really helps to lift the most vulnerable people out of poverty. That is what our objective should be. And that can only happen if, for instance, we have strong labor market institutions, whether it's being through collective bargaining, where trade unions exist and have a strong representation, through social protection that reaches really the most vulnerable population, or through minimum wages where they are properly enforced and help especially vulnerable workers to benefit from it. But it also required, as I mentioned before, that we kind of focus our labor market policies towards a transition away from some of these occupations into a better paid occupation. So really not, instead of just basically passively looking into push people into employment and hoping that somehow miraculously they would find good employment opportunities, really making sure that we accompany these people through targeted education and through targeted support that help them to find and occupy those occupations that really help them grow in the future. And there are tools that we can use now to anticipate some of these transitions better. And we can also identify those transitions that are likely to be dead ends and to which we shouldn't push people, in order to avoid that we kind of create a precarious workforce in the future.
ILO economist Eckhard Ernst and Just Jobs Network president Sabina Dewan, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Look for Sabina Dewan and Eckhard Ernst's article titled Rethinking the World of Work in the December 2020 issue of Finance and Development magazine. Go to imf.org/FND to read it online, or download the Finance and Development app to read it on your mobile device. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe if you like what you're hearing. You can also follow us on Twitter @IMF_podcast. Thanks for listening.